This is Regionally Speaking on Lakeshore Public Radio. I'm Chris Nolte. La Lumiere School is described as an independent, co-educational boarding and day prep school. It's a college prep school located out in the woods in LaPorte County. And like all other schools here in Northwest Indiana, they have been having to deal with problems of education during the pandemic. But they seem to be able to have found a plan that has worked very well since the summer months to be able to get youngsters back in school and back in-person learning. Let's find out more about it. Adam Kronk is the head of school at La Lumiere School in LaPorte County, and he's with us on Regionally Speaking. Thank you very much for joining us today.
Morning, Chris. Thank you for having me.
Well, give us an idea, if you will, first, how the school is situated, certainly physically, but also, I guess, educationally, to be able to jump in and have to figure out how we're going to be able to continue classes or conduct classes, for that matter, during the pandemic.
Sure. So Chris, we are a pretty small school. We've got about 185 students, grades 9 through 12. Half of them, a little bit more than half of them, are day students who commute from about a one-hour radius. And then the rest are boarding students who come from, the region, but also all over the world. We've got students mm-hmm. from 14 different countries here. And with our unique setup of our campus, you know, we're on over 150 acres out here in LaPorte County, and the small class sizes we have, which are about an average of 11 students per class, we were just able to control some things that I think a lot of schools don't have the luxury to control. The main thing is we spent almost the entire fall semester outside. So we set up 10 outdoor learning classrooms, an amphitheater, a couple of permanent pavilions, and then some temporary tents, and basically we beamed the internet out there and made sure everyone was hooked up to Wi-Fi, and spent the time again almost the entire fall outside, and the combo of that plus masks and physical distancing really gave everyone peace of mind that we were, you know, at a pretty low risk of spreading COVID at all.
Mm-hmm. Now, since you have a relatively small size in not only student body and faculty as well, did you find it a big problem to be able to make this shift from all indoor learning to the outdoor? And, of course, now with the colder weather, having to probably shift around back into indoor learning, too.
It has taken a lot of resolve and resiliency from our students, our teachers, and our families. But the idea is that we wanted to prioritize in-person learning because the way that we do education here is really, really based on having a solid, close-knit relationship between students and teachers. And we just felt that there's really no substitute for doing that in person. And so people were willing to, you know, be outside on a windy day or wear an extra layer or whatever it had to be if it meant that they could be with their classmates, be with their teachers, and continue the learning process. So we did set a threshold where we said if the average daily temperature was below 42 degrees, then we would have a remote day. Mm-hmm. And I will say that Chris, one of the things that happened is we got so lucky with the weather. I mean, we had such a mild, beautiful fall. We only actually had five remote days between the beginning of school in mid-August and Thanksgiving break, which was frankly more than I would have bet on. Mm-hmm. Yeah. And we had planned all along to be remote for the final 3 weeks of the semester between Thanksgiving and Christmas break because we knew that families would travel to see loved ones on Thanksgiving, and we just didn't want to risk having to start over, with a population that had just traveled. So we've done 1 week of remote review last week, and this is the first of 2 weeks of final assessment, which will also be remote. The other thing to mention, Chris, is that we started the year asking every single student and teacher to submit a negative COVID test before they came back to school. Mm-hmm. We used that as a baseline, but then we proactively tested a quarter of our school every single week. And it really enabled us to keep a handle on whether or not you're always going to have, especially with young people, you're going to have folks who might have COVID but be completely asymptomatic and inadvertently spread it. And so we were able to. We did have a handful of cases here and there over the course of the month, but we were able to sniff those out early, isolate and quarantine the students, and we really didn't have any instances of one student passing it to another on campus, which was a huge part of being able to do.
Yeah, that's great. Great news. Now, for the students that attend La Lumiere School, what classes or types of classes can you put on these outdoor settings that you say that the special, these big event tents that people see up around and other locations outdoors, as well as having to have some classes indoors? I'm sure that inside classes still have to happen because you have certain classes that require it, right?
We really only had a couple of classes inside this year, and those were the laboratory-based sciences. And they're in a very large space that's very well ventilated and again, with just kind of small sections of students who kept their mask on the whole time. But pretty much everything else was taught, as you said, either in a tent or an amphitheater or an outdoor pavilion. And what we believe is that almost every subject ought to be able to taught in a way that's called the Harkness method, which is essentially the teacher and the rest of the students are all sitting in a circle, and the mode of inquiry is much less lecture-based, and it's more about generating a discussion and then eliciting the responses from one another. And so because that's the mode of learning that we kind of hold up as the model here, we were able to do that with almost all of our classes in the fall.
We're talking with Adam Kronk. He's the head of school at La Lumiere School, which is, by the way, a private school. And it's located in LaPorte County out in the country around a beautiful lake and beautiful outdoor setting. So it seems, Adam, to be able to work out well to be able to have these classes outdoors. I'm sure that there are some routines that you have to abandon or have to modify greatly because you would normally, I guess, get a lot of students together perhaps for some things, and you couldn't do that. You'd have to social distance so much.
Absolutely. One of the hallmarks of our day here is that every day we start as an entire school community in our fine arts building together for our morning meeting. We make announcements, check in, talk about how things are going. And then a quick prayer and go about the day. And that was not possible this semester because it would have been too many human beings in a building. And so we have teams here. They're called Heads Cup teams. And it's a little bit like the houses in Harry Potter. Everybody joins one of these teams when they matriculate as a student. And then they're on that team for their 4 years here. And if they have any siblings or relatives who go here, they're on that same team. It's really a sense of pride and identity that goes across the grade levels. And so what we did is we chopped our morning meeting up into four groups by Heads Cup team. And so every morning that quarter of the school would meet together, again, at an outside location, and just connect, talk through the day, and have that touch point. So that was a way that we kind of had to work around or adapt with one of the key elements of our close-knit community. And in fact, for these three remote learning weeks that are spanning the Thanksgiving to Christmas phase of the semester, we're doing that online each morning. I just was on there an hour ago with my Heads Cup team. Mm-hmm. And, you use technology to your advantage, but there really is, there's no substitute for being in person. And again, we just kind of, we did everything we possibly could to make sure that we could spend as much of the semester together as possible.
Okay. Now, Anna, we've talked about the students here in large part. How about the faculty? What have they had to do to make the adjustment here? And they were luckily able to keep it, I guess, the change to a minimum. But what do they have to do to try to still continue to educate in person during the pandemic?
Dress in layers, be flexible, be understanding. We would have I will say this. It was a tall order for our teachers here, like it has been everywhere. They're doing, you know, they are also stressed out by a pandemic that's scary for all humans. And so they have to have that cook in the background while they're doing more than they've ever had to do. They might be out at an outdoor classroom, and here's a breeze that kicks up, and now the handouts are blowing across the grass or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
And, you know, and the other thing that happens is when we would have a student who was out sick, or we actually had a couple of our international students who couldn't make it back into the country this fall, and so they were learning remotely during the live teaching that the teachers were doing to the students who were in person. And so, as you see at many schools, the teachers have to really be able to improvise and teach to the learners who are right in front of them, but also keep someone looped in who's joining via technology. And it's been a lot of work, but we're a close-knit community of teachers as well who really care about the mission, and they're really invested in their students. One of the things about this school is that they just have fewer students that they teach, and so they can kind of spend more time developing those relationships. And I think what that cultivates then is a lasting commitment to them. And our teachers have just been willing to do whatever they have to get that done in person.
Okay, now you mentioned here, it was earlier in our conversation, that right now you're in the remote mode because of being between breaks between Thanksgiving and Christmas. When the spring semester starts, what is likely to be the setup then?
Sure. If we use that same 42-degree threshold, as I've told people, we might not be in class till April, right?
Yeah, that's right.
We're in Northwest Indiana, and you know how it goes. So we... as soon as we sent the students home on Thanksgiving, we got our facilities and our leadership team together and just planned on, okay, what's it going to look like starting January 11? Certainly using every indoor nook and cranny of the school, chopping the classrooms up into smaller pieces. I may even have a class that meets in my office here because you could fit, you know, an independent study with two or three students and a teacher in it.
Right.
Every indoor classroom will have an air purifier and a carbon dioxide detector, which is one of the ways that science has shown us recently that if you monitor the carbon dioxide level in a room, that's a good proxy for if it's below a certain threshold, the viral load, if any, of COVID will be low enough not to endanger anyone. So we'll probably have open windows. We'll have air purifiers, carbon dioxide detectors, and small classes. And then the second thing that we've really spent a lot of time on is making sure that we've got plenty of space on campus for students to eat lunch, because that is the one thing you can't do with a mask on.
Yeah.
And so really having people spread out, having those little plexiglass dividers, and keeping them safe while they're refueling during the lunch period.
Now, Adam, since you have the students well-informed, the faculty is well-informed, have you got any feedback from any of the alums? Since La Lumiere School is known for having some notable alums, from basketball stars to at least one stand-up comedian, Jim Gaffigan is an alum. And, of course, you have a very notable judge, Chief Justice of the U.S. Supreme Court, John Roberts, is an alum. Have you gotten any feedback from any of the alums as to how they feel that you've been doing so far?
Yes, they've been thrilled, and I think, you know, they're spread out around the world and seeing what the school systems in their areas are able to do. And I think I've gotten a lot of phone calls and emails just saying, so glad to see La Lumiere with its foot on the gas, prioritizing that kind of special instruction that we do here. So it's been a decent amount of work, and I can't emphasize enough that proactive surveillance testing really does also help, you know, make sure you have an accurate picture of what's going on in your student population. But our families, our alums, our students, they're all just, you know, we've had one of our mantras has been this year, we can do hard things.
Mm-hmm.
And if everybody is willing to do their part, then I think the community is better off. And so, yeah, our alums have been very proud of what we've been able to accomplish.
Well, Adam, thank you very much for spending time with us to talk about how La Lumiere School has been dealing with learning in the pandemic. And in particular, I like the phrase that is expressed here as to the approach being called Learning by the Lake. Well, certainly it shows the beautiful setting that you have the school in, but also, I guess, with the outdoor learning, it just kind of adds to that as well, too. And we hope to have the best for you in the rest of the semester, and hopefully we'll have this under some control here before the next academic year comes up.
Absolutely. Well, Chris, thank you so much for having me. And I do think, you know, it's for our school and any school, you have to ask, how do you not just survive COVID, but how do you use it to make your school and your mission stronger? And so we're in this beautiful setting, and one of the things that I'm hoping is that once this pandemic is behind us, we still spend a decent amount of time out in nature. It's good for the soul. It's good to reduce stress levels. And so we're just really grateful, and I really appreciate you having me on.
Well, you may have come up with another way for educational purposes here, staying more outside when you can, even if we get the virus under control. It's nice to hear that,
That's
too,
right.
as well, too. Adam Cronk is the head of school for La Lumiere School, which is the independent, co-head, boarding and day prep school, college prep school, which is located in LaPorte County. This next story comes to you from the Welcome Project at Valparaiso University. The Welcome Project collects first-person stories and pairs these with intentional conversations to help forge stronger ties within and across our communities.
I grew up in an area not very far from where my mother originally migrated when they moved to Gary. There were new apartments established over there, and it was called East Point Terrace. In fact, they still exist. A lot of great memories there. We were the first family to live in that apartment complex. I remember coming up to the complex after they got married, and the cement was still a little wet, and my mother gets out of the car and she etches David and Lenita on the corner of a sidewalk. Periodically, I actually go back and visit that site because those are my fondest memories. And you can barely see traces of the etching there. And it's just, it's surreal, if you will. And it's just a good memory for me. In 1973, all of that changed for me. My parents split up, and my mom moved to Glen Park to live with one of her sisters, who was actually one of the first families in the Glen Park area. Having done so, my mom realized very early on that she wanted to provide the best educational opportunity for me. The public school system was definitely functioning then in Gary, and there are a lot of success stories that have come out of the public school system. Perhaps it was me that she honed in on in my personality, that she understood I needed a little bit more structure. Perhaps it was the fact that her and my dad broke up and she noted I needed more structure because of the absence of a father figure. But for whatever the reasons were, she decided to send me to St. Mark's School. It was somewhere right around November of 1973. I'm in fourth grade and my teacher's name is Sister Elise, and she had the habit and all of that. And there were just a lot of differences that existed. But most of all, academically speaking, it was very, very structured. And from a discipline perspective, it was absolutely structured. There was another dynamic that existed in that for 4 years, I was the only African-American student in my class. And so at a point where you're trying to understand or just realize who you are as a person, I found myself becoming a different person, if for no other reason, to just get along and be comfortable in the environment that I was, not only socially, but there was a whole religious component to it as well. To go from a school that was predominantly or perhaps 100% African American to just the complete opposite, being the only African American student in my class, was a little bit of a culture shock. But I've always been competitive, and I jumped right in and just wanted to be able to perform or excel at the level that the students in there were. And what I discovered is that there weren't very many differences. I mean, we looked a little different, but I was just as intelligent as those students. and I was able to keep up with the curriculum just as I did in the other school. But in addition to that, my mom wanted to make certain of that, and so I remember a lot of long evenings going over all of the homework that I was provided, and so she continue to be integrally involved in my education. And looking back at it, I would say my mom made a pretty good decision in that regard.
You can find more regional stories at welcomeproject.valpo.edu. There are skyscrapers built of wood in other countries, but now the idea is coming to the U.S.
So I want you to imagine a skyscraper that is constructed not from steel, not from concrete, but mostly of wood. I'm asking you this because Milwaukee is soon going to be home to the world's tallest timber skyscraper. Susan Bentz from member station WUWM has more.
It's hard to imagine any kind of tower on this nondescript construction site, formerly home to a corner pizzeria in downtown Milwaukee. Architect Jason Korb designed the 25-story building that will stretch to the sky.
They have to drive these pile foundations down up to 165 feet. And you can see they're starting to weld several pieces of deep foundation together.
Developer Tim Gockman says while steel and concrete do factor into the project, its focal point is a warehouse full of timber manufactured specifically for this project.
They're actually fairly standard pieces of dimensional lumber.
Softwood species like Douglas fir and southern yellow pine are harvested, milled, and groomed for what's called dimensional stability.
They're being glued, pressed together in a factory. And because it's being done by a machine, it is infinitely more precise.
Mass timber first got noticed in the U.S. and Canada about 6 years ago, but Austria has been fabricating it for tall buildings for nearly 30 years. What's special about the Milwaukee project is its height. When the high-end apartment complex opens in 2022, it will top the height of the world's tallest wood structure that's now in Norway. Tim Gockman's enthusiasm for the material is helping Brian Brashaw. He's with the U.S. Forest Service and is on a mission to cultivate mass timber markets around the country.
We are seeing incredibly innovative projects that are pushing the envelope, that are creating this opportunity.
Brashaw says innovative structures spark advances in mass timber technology, which in turn helps with forest planning.
It gives us the ability to manage lands that are in need of forest management. And many forests are really economic drivers for rural communities.
Daniel Safarik is with the Council on Tall Buildings and Urban Habitat. He sees mass timber construction as key to housing the world's ever more urban population.
And to have a material that could allow us to build in high density safely and which locks up carbon, you know, seems like a win-win-win.
Trees sequester carbon dioxide and the wood holds it captive, even when made into lumber and used to create a skyscraper. For NPR News, I'm Susan Bentz in Milwaukee.
That's it for Regionally Speaking for today. I'm Chris Nolte. Thanks for being with us, and we'll be back with you tomorrow.